It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, alcohol is a big part of our state's culture. We talked to one Wisconsinite about her journey through alcoholism and recovery.
But first, we catch up on the world of politics. Yesterday, of course, Super Tuesday, which further solidified Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump's leads for their respective parties.
And Speaker of the House Paul Ryan took on Trump over his reaction to some controversial endorsements.
Harry Enson is back with us now. He's a senior political writer and analyst for 538. Harry, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
So looking at Super Tuesday, did anything by way of the results shock you?
I don't know if anything shocked me per se. I would say on the Republican side, what to me is so interesting is if you average the vote across all the states that voted yesterday, Donald Trump got 34.5% of the vote. And if you average the vote of the first four states that voted before yesterday, he got 34.5% of the vote. For someone who's supposedly rising like an eagle, soaring like a phoenix, it seems to me that, in fact, his support has been fairly steady. That's enough in this divided field. But let's see what happens if people actually drop out, though nobody may drop out given they're all competitive with him.
So how about over on the Democratic side of things?
You know, nothing really surprising there. I mean, Hillary Clinton continues to dominate with African-Americans who are a base of the Democratic Party. I think the worst vote percentage she got among African-Americans in any of the states that voted yesterday was in Oklahoma, where she won, I think, 71% of the vote. And when you're winning only 71% of the vote, that's your worst. You're doing fairly well. In other states, she got well into the 80s. And in Alabama, I think she got 93% of the African-American vote. She has got a huge pledged delegate lead now. And given that Democrats award their delegates proportionately, it just seems very difficult looking at the math to understand how Bernie Sanders can come back.
And she had this to say last night as she celebrated her victory.
Now, I'm not interested in condemning whole categories of people or businesses. I'm just interested in making things right. So let there be no doubt. If you cheat your employees, exploit consumers, pollute our environment, or rip off the taxpayers, we're going to hold you accountable.
Hillary Clinton, fresh off a victory last night in Super Tuesday. And it's worth pointing out, though, that Bernie Sanders, he's still in there. But how strong is her position vis-a-vis Bernie Sanders?
I mean, Bernie Sanders is going to stay in this race for as long as he wants to. He has the money to do so. The problem is Jeb Bush learned money doesn't equal victories. And he can spend and spend and spend, but he's made no inroads with African-Americans. He lost Hispanics by 42 percentage points last night in Texas, and she's just got a huge pledged delegate lead. And if you just look at the states where he does well, there tend to be smaller states, they tend to be caucus states, they tend to be white states, and there just aren't enough pledged delegates in those states to really challenge Clinton's lead.
So given that, as you pointed out, he's got money to spare, I guess, right now at this point, so that's not going to be the deciding factor. What do you think will be the final shape of this matchup between Hillary and Bernie Sanders?
You know, I must admit I can't read people's minds, so I don't know exactly when if Bernie Sanders will drop out, but I think he has a message that's clearly caught on with a large number of voters on the Democratic side, not a majority, but a large percentage of voters. And I think that if nothing else, he has pushed Hillary Clinton to the left on any number of issues. And I think that if you talk to his followers, they would say that alone should be enough for him to stay in the race. And why not? He has the money and he has a right to run as any American does.
Now, looking over at the Republican side by way of comparison, seems like there is this sort of almost Reformation-like enthusiasm revving up Donald Trump supporters. Is there, do you see, a corollary on the Democratic side for Bernie Sanders? Is it playing out maybe just a little bit differently?
I would say that the Bernie Sanders folks are really these hardcore supporters who would go through thick and thin for Bernie Sanders, which is why he does so well in caucus states. Well, Donald Trump, in fact, does pretty terribly in caucus states. These are low propensity voters for Trump. These are voters who don't tend to turn out. The Sanders voters do tend to turn out, which is unfortunate for Sanders because he always talks about that he needs a record turnout in order to be able to win in primaries. He's not getting that. In fact, he's doing better when there's lower turnout in caucus states. While Trump is just a very different guy altogether. I mean, they're both outsiders for sure, but it's a very different type of voter that they're going after in my mind.
But Trump is increasing turnout, isn't he?
Well, there's increased turnout on the Republican side. There's a question of whether that's Trump over whether that's people who are voting in opposition to Trump. And more than that, the Republican side is just so much more competitive, right? So it's not really surprising that there would be more people that turned out. I mean, there was record turnout on the Dem side in 1988 and in 1980. And, in 1988, it wasn't exactly that there were people revving up the field. I mean, Dick Gephardt, Paul Simon, and Michael Dukakis are not exactly people that I think of when I'm listening to great all-time political speeches. But it was a competitive campaign, and that's what the Republican side is. It's very competitive. But to me, it's not surprising that you're seeing very large turnout.
We're talking Super Tuesday results with 538's Harry Enten right now. And here's a little bit of Donald Trump last night declaring victory.
We are going to be a much finer party, we're going to be a unified party. I mean, to be honest with you, and we are going to be a much bigger party. And you can see that happening. We're going to be a much bigger party.
So what about that, Harry? Donald Trump, the unifier, is that true?
He's certainly trying. If nothing else, Donald Trump can say one thing on Monday, say another thing on Tuesday, and say a third thing on Wednesday. I mean, yes, he is pulling in voters who had formerly voted Democratic, but these were voters who were turning over to the Republican side anyway. If you look at the polls, you look at the general election polls, at least at this point, he is not pulling over Democrats to be able to vote for him in the general election. That may change. But so far, there's no real evidence that Donald Trump is somehow going to get all these new Democratic voters on his side. And even if he does get these white Democrats, he's trailing, for instance, in an Ohio Quinnipiac poll, 92-1 among African Americans. He's turning off as many voters as he is bringing in to the Republican side
but
if he were to nominate.
Is it fair to say that he's reaching pockets of the conservative vote that maybe were feeling unrepresented before? Now they're coming into the tent.
I would say that he is reaching segments of the population that perhaps didn't feel like they had a voice before. I wouldn't say they're necessarily conservative, but I would say they're people who felt like they did not have a voice. White working class voters in particular who seem to be revved up by his campaign. I don't think that there's anyone that would doubt that. The real question is, how large is that percentage of the vote? And more than that, when he's bringing in these voters to the process, who is he turning off? We've already seen a number of Republicans, lifelong Republicans, saying that they would not vote for Donald Trump in the general election. It's Ben Sasse, a senator from Nebraska, Governor Charlie Baker of Massachusetts. We hear these people say, never Trump, we're not voting for a general. He starts losing voters. It doesn't matter how many picks up. What matters at the end of the day is the net gain.
So these people you're talking about, these voters that Trump may be reaching, are these undecideds? Are these independents? How do you categorize who these people might be?
I would say that there are people, if you ask them who they identify, they would say independent. And then if you say, which way do you lean, they almost always lean Republican. These are voters who tend not to necessarily vote in primaries, but they do vote in general elections. But they're low propensity voters, which is why, as I mentioned earlier, they don't seem to be showing up in the caucuses and why Trump last night lost in Alaska and lost in Minnesota.
And Ted Cruz, again, still there with Donald Trump, and he won his home state. It was not a given going in yesterday. How big a win was that for him?
Well, I would say it wasn't a given. I think most of the polls indicate that he's going to win, but it wasn't just that he won. It was the size of the victory. He won every single congressional district in that state. He got well into the 40s in terms of the vote total. But he didn't just win Texas. He also won in Oklahoma, won a decent victory there, and he beat Trump in Alaska. Most of the best states that Cruz has, they've already voted, but he's clearly going to be here for at least a little while longer, because when you win, that gives you credit to move on. But Cruz still has a big problem in northern states, still has a big problem in states that don't have large evangelical populations. He really made no dent in Massachusetts, no dent in Vermont, no dent in Virginia.
And we just got news this afternoon that Republican candidate Ben Carson issued a statement to his supporters last night saying he doesn't see a path forward. Good news for Ted Cruz?
The poll, yeah, I think most of the plurality of voters would go to Cruz, but the polls do indicate that Carson voters would be more split than all just going to Cruz. But remember, Carson only has a small percentage of the vote right now, so it's not going to make a huge difference. I will say that one difference it will make is we won't have to go to Carson in the debates anymore and him complaining about how much time he has.
And Harry, just super briefly, what are you looking for in the next couple primaries?
Can Donald Trump continue to win? If he's all about winning, let's see if he can continue to win. The delegate amounts aren't that high, but we have a few primaries this Saturday. Let's see if he can continue winning there.
Great. Harry, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That was Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538. He joins us every week to give us an overview of what's happening in Washington. Wisconsin's troubled relationship with alcohol has been well documented. Multiple national studies have shown Wisconsin to be the heaviest drinking state in the country, or the state with the highest rate of binge drinking. One expert said the average number of drinks consumed by an individual per year in Wisconsin is 148 drinks higher than the national average.
One Wisconsinite joins us now to share her story of alcoholism and recovery. Michelle Devine-Giese is president of Step Industries, a social enterprise that provides vocational rehabilitation, counseling, even housing for recovering alcoholics and drug addicts in Neenah and Milwaukee. Michelle, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, before we get into the work you do at STEP, I want to start with your personal story. How did you become an alcoholic?
When I was in college, I think I was battling depression, undiagnosed. And I think at that point I was trying to self-medicate and found that alcohol helped. By the time I graduated, I was pretty much a maintenance drinker. And shortly after graduation, maybe about 2 years, I found my life just really spiraling out of control, where I was drinking almost all the time.
A maintenance drinker, what do you mean by that?
I really couldn't function without alcohol. So I would drink to get up in the morning. I would drink to get rid of my hangover. I would drink to stop shaking. I would drink to go to sleep. When I'd wake up in the middle of the night, I would drink so I could go back to sleep. I really couldn't function. I couldn't be normal without having alcohol in my system.
And I read that, you know, coming out of high school, you wouldn't be somebody who you'd consider a usual suspect. It isn't something that friends and family or you would have thought would happen to you.
No. In high school, you know, we had the occasional party, you know, just like everybody does in high school. I was captain of the pom-pom squad. I, you know, graduated with good grades, was going to college. You know, it kind of seemed like I had everything going for me. And not the person you would necessarily think. I mean, my high school career, I had almost perfect attendance. I wasn't the person skipping school to go, you know, smoke or, you know, to go drink. And then, you know, I really think it was, you know, part of the depression that then once I got caught up in that and, you know, couldn't really get myself out of it, then I think it really just took off really quickly, and I became that addict pretty fast.
And so you're a maintenance drinker. You say you couldn't function without alcohol, but in your head, were you thinking, I have a problem, there's something wrong, or is this something you couldn't believe about yourself?
Both, I think. You know, I think there were times when, you know, I would know that I was different than other people. Other people could have a couple drinks and then go home or go to bed. And I was always that person that drank until they were drunk and until I would pass out. And I knew that was different, but I don't think I knew at that point that I was alcoholic. But I think once I started drinking to get rid of the shakes in the morning and to get rid of the hangover and then couldn't function without doing that, that's when I kind of went, I think I have a serious problem. But not ready to admit at that point, though.
Right. There were people around you who must have been noticing this problem. You were aware that you had a problem. But why was it hard at that point to get help?
I think I knew enough about alcoholism that once I admitted that I had a problem, that was it. I couldn't ever be a social drinker. And for me, the thought of never having alcohol again was way too overwhelming. I wasn't going 4 hours without alcohol, so to think about going 4 days, 4 months, 4 years, that was just way too big of a thought for me.
A lot of people talk about hitting bottom before they seek help, and I understand you had an experience where things really were so out of control that you admitted, you told someone you needed help. What happened, and who did you reach out to?
Yeah, I was on my way back from homecoming weekend at UW-Stout, where I had gone to school, and I caused a car accident. And before I caused the accident, I had been thinking, life is out of control, but I don't know what to do. And I had family that I could have talked to, but I think I was too embarrassed and ashamed and had been lying about it for too long that I just couldn't get in my head that I could tell them. And when the police officer came to the car accident, I just blurted out to him, I need help. And he said, for what? I think he thought I was injured. And I said, I'm an alcoholic and I need help. I need to go to treatment. And he told my parents. And the next day, I was in inpatient treatment. I mean, they did a lot of hoop jumping. My dad and my sister spent a lot of time, you know, trying to find the right avenue for me to get into treatment. And that window was so crucial that when I was ready to go to treatment, it was really important that we find something for me to do, for me to go to. And so by that next night at 5 o'clock, I was in patient treatment.
We're talking to Michelle Devine-Giese. She's president of Step Industries. She's talking about her own efforts to recover from alcoholism and to help other people recover from their own addictions. So, Michelle, eventually this path took you to Step, where you're now the president. What happened when you started working with and at Step?
I had been working part-time somewhere else where it was a normal place, and people would ask me to go out for a drink, and I knew I couldn't go. And so that was really hard for me. I felt out of place. I felt odd at that point. I was 25 years old. I wanted to hang out with friends and stuff. So then when I heard about STEP and they said it was only people in recovery worked there, I thought that's really interesting and I want to go check it out. So the next day I called and I had an interview and I got the job. And from the minute I got into orientation, it felt like home. It felt like I belonged. Because the team leader was talking about her addiction, her recovery, and it was like, this is exactly where I need to be. So I started working at STEP, and we have huddle every morning where we did the Serenity Prayer, and we read from a recovery-related book. We could talk about recovery-related issues and problems we might be having, and everybody just understood. There was no judgment. There was just compassion and caring and people here to help.
I'm hearing a really powerful statement here about having peers going through the same thing. I mean, at first you were struggling this alone, didn't know who to turn to, didn't know how to think about this. Having this community going through the same thing sounds like made a really huge difference for you.
I am not sure I would have stayed sober without it because I was so ashamed, you know, when I first got into recovery, of what I had caused to my family and the embarrassment and the car accident. And there was just so much shame and guilt. And having other people who knew exactly that feeling and saying, you know, it's a disease. You're not alone. You can get through this and you can turn your life around. And then seeing examples right at my workplace of people who had done that, you know, that were now successful and helping other people. And it just made me want that.
Well, now
that's why I'm still here.
Yeah, and now you are president of Step Industries. Obviously, you're committed to the mission. Talk about how it works. When someone today shows up with maybe alcohol addiction, maybe other drugs, what do they do at Step?
Well, they'll have the weirdest interview they've ever had, first off, because we want to talk about what they're doing for their recovery. How many meetings are they going to? Do they have a sponsor? You know, what are they doing to take care of themselves? We don't really care about the work history. We expect people to have a bad work history. So then we start people working in groups. So we do group orientation, and right there we're setting the stage. What got you to this spot in your life? How has your addiction impacted your vocational life? And then what do you want to do next? What's your goal? What do you want to see in 12 weeks when you have your first eval? Do you want to see that your attendance is improved or that you have a good attitude, you're a hard worker? You know, you tell us what is your goal. And then people go out and work with other people just like them. So we will inspect, sort, repackage, do bundle packaging, just about anything that can be outsourced and needs some hands to do it. We have a great, hardworking workforce that, you know, just loves new projects.
And Michelle, someone out there listening is going through what you went through, or maybe they've got a close family member. What would you say to them from where you are now to encourage them to take the first steps to getting through this?
I think if it's somebody who is suffering with addiction, just tell somebody you need help. get past the embarrassment, get past the shame, and just tell them you need help. There are people there to help you find what you need. You can call the AA hotline. There are treatment centers. If you just Google, you know, treatment centers in your area, call them. They will help you. If you have a loved one, that's a little harder because oftentimes, you know, my family was trying to get me to get help much earlier than I was ready to get that help. And that's really the key, is that we're not going to do it till we're ready. So there's some Al-Anon meetings that are good for people who have loved ones who are suffering. They can call a treatment center also and ask for options. There are a few places who will help do interventions. I think it all depends on the severity of what's happening. But I think one thing to make sure that loved ones don't do is enable. You don't want to bail people out. You don't want to take away their problems because often those consequences are what help get people into recovery.
Michelle, thanks a lot for sharing your story today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
That was Michelle Devine-Giese, president of Step Industries. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Race has emerged as a big topic in American culture in the presidential campaign and conversations about police-minority relationships. And here in Wisconsin, with worries about racial disparities in education, income, and incarceration rates.
But it can be a hard conversation for people to have, and issues of race are sometimes easier to avoid than they are to talk about. A new theater production at Madison College is trying to spark a productive conversations about issues of race and diversity.
The play is called Clyburn Park. It opens this weekend at Madison College's Mitby Theater, and we have a link to the schedule on the Central Time Facebook page.
We have a few people involved in the play with us now. Miranda Hawk is the director, and she's chair of communications and performing arts at Madison College. Miranda, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Also with us, Madison College student Shannon Hintz. She's founding member of the Madison College Street Team. We'll get into what that is in a bit. Shannon, hi.
Hi.
And on the phone, history instructor Jonathan Pollock is with us. He's the historian for this production. John, welcome back to the show.
Nice to be back, Rob. Thanks for calling.
Well, Miranda, give us the basics, first of all. What is Clyburn Park all about?
Clyburn Park actually takes place over the period of 50 years. We start in 1959 on the other side of Lorraine Hansberry's Raisin in the Sun, where we see the white family's perspective of a black family purchasing their home and the community reaction to that. The second act takes place in 2009, so we fast forward, we're in the same house, and it's changing hands again, and the neighborhood has changed. And all of these same issues have stayed the same.
Well, here's a little preview, a little taste of the play from rehearsals that you sent along.
No, I'm sorry. This is the most asinine. Half of my friends are black.
What?
And as is true for most normal people.
Name one.
Normal people tend to have
Name one.
Candace. I don't have to sit here compiling a list of...
You specifically said...
Teresa.
She works in your office. She's not a friend.
So, Miranda, touchy conversations. Yes. You mentioned just before the show, maybe over 15 appropriate. There is some language.
There
in
is
this
some
as
language.
Well.
Mm-hmm.
These are tense conversations people are having in this play.
They are, and Bruce Norris, the playwright, that's what he strive to do, is to put us in a situation where we are having conversations that we hear in our hallways or in our own living rooms, family members, sometimes even ourselves, but then we're also able to see the absurdity of it.
And Shannon, tell us a little bit about the community conversation. That's part of what the Madison College Street Team is involved in. What's going to happen there? There's one event on Sunday, I think it is.
Yes, March 6th. We are just talking about, the community issues and what Clyburn Park has to reflect on Madison.
And why was it important, do you think, to have Madison people, I know there are community leaders, audience members, why is it important for Madison, for people in Wisconsin, to have this play sparked by, or this discussion sparked by the play?
I think because there's a lot of things that are in the play that, you know, are relevant to Madison right now. You know, I mean, there are communities that are struggling and have, you know, issues with, you know, one side being rich and the other side being poor, and being able to put those two together and say we have an issue because, you know, people aren't listening to each other.
Now, John, you're the historian on this production. Can you tell us how this play handles this idea, this half century plus of race in the United States?
So it mainly deals with housing issues. And what I really like about the play, what I've enjoyed about working with the whole team that's putting it on, is that the issue of race is always... It's like not directly stated. It's there are a series of conversations that go on between characters in both parts of the play, where the issue of race is like in the background. It's kind of hinted at but not stated exactly. And I think looking at the way that people often talk about race today, talking about racism in the sense of the Klan or something like that is relatively rare and that's spectacular, and people say, oh, I can't believe that still exists and so forth. But in the more coded language that people use, that's something that like people were talking about earlier, it's that coded language. It's what people kind of talk about around their dining room tables and so on, and that's really what's in the play, is you get that vibe of something racist that's kind of hard to pin down, and that's what I think is really useful about the play, and that really explains race and housing issues in northern cities over the last 50 to 60 years.
Talking about a play called Clybourne Park being put on at Madison College. We have Miranda Hawk with us, Shannon Hintz, and John Pollock all involved in different ways with this production and a community conversation surrounding it. Miranda, one thing I understand about this play is that, you know, these are things in 1950s, mm-hmm. modern day, less changes in that time period than we might like to see. How does the play show that?
It's very blunt. But at the same time, we find ourselves laughing and then immediately wondering, oh, shoot, I should not have laughed at that. And so there, many of the conversations, many of the characters embody people that we know and sometimes can look at in our own mirrors. And with things that we say and don't even realize, as John was talking about, the undertone of difference. Bruce Norris also, as being discussed, he also talks about, or his characters debate, the value of disability, economy, mm-hmm. Politics. So one of the reviewers talking about the play said that nobody goes unscathed in this piece. He really takes a blunt object to everybody and makes us look at things that we don't really want to see, especially if we get comfortable. We get comfortable with the way we are interacting with people and we think we've progressed so far, but if we really look at it, we're still seeing ourselves and each other as different, and we're putting a value on those differences.
And John, I want to stay with that historical context a bit. This idea that in a lot of ways we're still talking about the same things in 2016 as we were in 1950. How much is still the same now or similar as it was then?
Wow. So things are similar. If we're just looking at residents on the ground, the rate of residential segregation has, and I don't have the stats in front of me right here, but residential segregation is a factor as much now as it was back in the 1950s. I mean, the neighborhoods that people live in are different. Obviously, areas that were farmland in the 1950s are now suburbs and exurbs of major cities. But the reality in walking around neighborhoods, looking at schools, there's been a lot of work on how schools have kind of resegregated after efforts to desegregate them in the 1970s. So while I think it's oversimplifying a little bit to say, oh, it's exactly the same as it was in the 50s. I think there was change, and then there's been change back. If you're just kind of taking a snapshot of 1959 and like 2009 when the play's set, then it looks pretty darn similar.
Shannon, I want to bring you back into this now. As a student and on this Madison College street team, first of all, what does the street team do, and especially regarding this kind of conversation?
Madison College street team is educating both faculty and students on racial diversity issues around campus. We talk about, you know, what's going on and how we can fix things, you know, in classrooms, you know, and just being able to understand better what we can do to be able to make the community and the campus more welcoming.
And I wonder how people are receiving that now, because I think there are stages over the last couple decades where somebody might say something that, and the students, maybe the faculty say, it sounds nice, busy, got a lot to do. But now, with everything that's been in the news lately, are people embracing this issue, wanting to have the conversations you're talking about?
Some faculty are. We do have a thing that we got a message that said, faculty just don't get it. And that's what actually started the street team. was that we wanted to educate, and that was the main reason we started, was to be able to go forward with that.
And a lot of students saying, yeah, this is a really important conversation to be having now.
Yes.
So I want to get into the community conversation part of this. Miranda, why theater to get this conversation started?
Well, theater is a great conversation starter, but of course I'm biased. I think we can see ourselves in these characters as much as sometimes we don't want to, but we are laughing along, and the conversations with the cast. When Jonathan came in and talked to us, and we were able to talk about the history and the politics that surrounded housing and race, and then after he left, we had some great conversations and how the students were feeling that they just thought it was in their heads. That, I did experience this. And then there were some other students involved in the production who didn't realize. And so as we were progressing and going through and talking about the facts behind this play, then they were talking about their own experiences and bringing themselves to it. And so the conversation it sparked out of that. And Shannon came to me also and said, how can we do more with this? And I thought, well, you know, it's a Chicago play, but it can be a Madison neighborhood as well.
We're talking about race and an effort to get people talking about race. Our guests are Miranda Hawk, Shannon Hintz, and John Pollock. They're all involved in a Madison College production of the play Clybourne Park and a community conversation centered around that play.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you been part of a community conversation about race? Is this an issue that's hard for you to talk about? And is there a place where you've had a good, maybe an eye-opening conversation about race in America? Call 800-642-1234. We continue our conversation with Miranda Hawk, Shannon Hintz, and Jonathan Pollock. They're all part of a Madison College production of the play Clybourne Park and a community conversation about issues of race raised in the play.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you think it's difficult, tough to talk to people, maybe your coworkers, friends, family, about race and racism? Is this one of those topics that you just avoid at the dinner table, like people avoid politics and religion? Is there a setting where you have felt comfortable having these kind of conversations? Call in now at 800-642-1234. And speaking of conversations, Miranda, one of the centerpieces here is this community conversation, I think, after one of the productions of the play. And you brought in people from the community. So what kind of people did you want to reach out to and have part of this conversation?
Well, we've reached out to a number of folks, and I'm still waiting on a confirmation from a couple of them. But Gloria Jones-Bay is one of the folks who has confirmed, and she is a part-time instructor at Madison College, but also very active in the Madison community. Jonathan Pollock. He is also a featured panelist. Lucia Nunez is our vice president of diversity and inclusion issues at Madison College. And she's going to be not just talking about the Madison community, but the campus community, what's happening within our own hallways, and how the themes are reflected as well. And then we have Darrell Connor, who is with WIBA Radio.
And Shannon, when these kind of conversations happen, and maybe looking forward to this one on Sunday, do you think people are reluctant to have conversations about race? Is this something that people don't even want to start, worried they'll say the wrong thing or they don't want to open a door?
They don't. They really don't. I mean, it can be an issue just right in the hallway. Someone will talk to you, you know, and just... I had a personal thing where they actually said to me, I didn't know that you were, you know, black. I didn't know you were biracial, you know, and I... just because of the way I talked, you know, and I didn't know what to say to that. It's just being able to bring that out in the open and be able to say something about it and say, that does hurt, you know, that does hurt to hear that, and just be able to talk. I mean, people, they won't.
Now, in this play, as we heard in the little clip, some of these conversations are painful. I mean, do you think it's important to, accept that it's going to be painful sometimes and keep going anyway?
Yeah. I mean, we had a conversation with the Madison College Street Team before, and we had faculty that honestly didn't know how to handle the situation. They stood in a group for 15 minutes just talking on end, going, what do we do in a situation like this? What do we say? How do we react to this? You know?
We've had formal training. Mm-hmm. We've had lots of it. But as faculty, we can find ourselves in our classroom, like I have, with a student saying, really something that everybody would have assumed was not appropriate. And that student who made the comment didn't realize. And it's a teaching moment, but at the time you're realizing that it's not the formal training, it's hearts and minds at stake.
We're talking about race and talking about race. it all centers around a play at Madison College, Clybourne Park. It's a play about talking about race, too. We have Miranda Hawk, Shannon Hintz, and Jonathan Pollock. They're all involved in the production of this play and a community conversation. Now, John, you are the historian in this play, and I wonder just your role in this. How did you present the history on the two ends of this spectrum? How did you kind of flesh out the script for the people participating?
Yeah, so in the 1950s, I did a lot more history for Act One, obviously, because it's set in the 50s. So I talked a little bit about Lorraine Hansberry's play Raisin in the Sun, and how this is kind of an answer to it in some ways, how it kind of builds on the earlier play. I talked about, the 1959 is this really interesting period, because you've got the Brown versus Board of Education decision in 54 that ended segregation by law, that after that you couldn't have housing developments or schools that were closed to blacks or for blacks only. But it's before the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 65. So it's this kind of limbo. And so I talked about, what led to restrictive covenants that prevented blacks from buying into previously all-white neighborhoods. And so I kind of laid that groundwork. I talked a lot about Jim Crow, and especially Jim Crow in the North. As we've said, the play's set in Chicago, and I think when we talk about the Civil Rights era, one of the things I tried to really hammer home to the cast was that we often focus on the South. We focus on Martin Luther King's early organizing and students integrating lunch counters and so forth. And people kind of take away from that, oh, well, if South is the opposite of North and all this prejudice, all this overt racism was still going on in the South, then it must not have been in the North. And so my presentation was all about, no, that's absolutely not the case. Discrimination in the North was overt. It was visible. People felt it every day. And I talked about, especially since I was working with actors, and this is something I don't normally get to do in history, I talked about how would the experience of Jim Crow in the North, where there's not supposed to be any law against blacks living where they want to and so forth, but in practice there kind of was, how would that affect how people carried themselves? How would that affect how people talked, how the characters talked to each other in the play? And so that was a lot of fun to explore. The actors kind of ran with it and talked about their own character and suggested, so my character would kind of do this or carry herself such and such a way. And that's how I really worked the history into it.
And Miranda, John was saying, people think, oh, racism, civil rights, that all happened in the South, not the North. Not true, he says. And recently there's been a conversation about Madison in particular viewing itself through a certain lens that says, oh, no, these things don't happen here. And then we've heard from Reverend Alex G. on the show on the Justified Anger Movement saying, in many ways, Madison is the worst place in Wisconsin in a lot of ways. So does that inform your production of this play?
Oh, very much so. Because that happens in this play repeatedly, where there is a level of comfort that everybody thinks they're on the same page, and it takes a while to dig through the layers, and you're laughing at things and responding to things, and then you realize, oh, no, this train has gone off the rails completely. So it's a great play to start that conversation, but as the playwright indicates, and you will find in both acts, there isn't a resolution. There isn't an answer suggested or recommended. We don't see these characters feel better. In fact, quite the opposite. Even through, as the audience is laughing hysterically at some points, there isn't an answer. And we're finding that in our own schools, in our own neighborhoods, in our own community. There isn't an answer yet.
So, Shannon, there's not a happy, tidy resolution in the play, but when the play is over, what are you hoping that people take away from seeing this, from having this community conversation?
I'm hoping that they will be able to, have those feelings and be able to talk about them. And that's part of the reason we're having the community conversation, is to be able to talk with people, and discuss what happens, because I feel like people could go out of it going, what do I do? How do I, react to these things? How do I, how can I change things? How can I make sure I'm not stepping, on places I don't want to? Yeah.
So Madison College is one place. This is one play. How would you recommend people in other communities maybe try to replicate what you're doing on this street team doing with this production of the play? Is this something you could see happening not just in your college?
I mean, I would hope so. Mm-hmm.
And there's many plays that revolve around a similar theme. Bruce Norris isn't the only one to take the other side or other perspective, but also really to talk, really to communicate. And it sounds so simple to have that open mind and open heart, but I think that's part of what's happened from this play and working with the cast. They have responded to the issues. They've been able to have conversations. And you will not leave this production and be silent in the car. You won't. It's not possible. You will be talking about it.
And briefly, John, as we wrap up, do you see some kind of turning point here where we're hungry for these conversations at this point in American history?
I think there are multiple points where that kind of hunger has shown up, where people are eager to have the conversations. I think there's some distance between being eager to have the conversation and actually have it. And then I think there's further distance to go from talking about issues of race and inequality to actually doing something about that. So especially in that second gap, I think there are definitely people out there who are eager to have those conversations, but it remains to be seen what exactly those impacts will be and what conversations will result.
We'll leave it there for now. Thanks to all of our guests for joining us. We've been hearing from Miranda Hawk, Shannon Hintz, and Jonathan Pollock. They're all involved in the Madison College production of Clybourne Park. That's a play, and then there's a community conversation about race on one of the productions. The play opens at Madison College's Mitby Theater. We've got a link to the schedule on the Central Time Facebook page.
A happy birthday observed today to Theodore Geisel, better known to the world as Dr. Seuss. This is the guy who brought us Horton, Here's a Who, The Lorax, and Green Eggs and Ham. He would have been 112 years old today. And in honor, we have a little quiz. You can play along with Rob.
All right.
Rob, the goal here is for you to complete the following Seuss lines in correct fashion.
And
or acceptable
fashion.
Right, exactly. Okay, here we go. One fish, two fish.
Old fish, new fish. No, I'm just kidding. Red fish, blue fish.
Very good. All one right. In the bag. I do not like green eggs and ham.
I do not like them, Sam. I am. Too easy. Make it harder.
I do not like them in a house.
I do not like them with a mouse.
A person's a person.
Wait, that's a different one.
We switched.
A person's a person. I don't know that.
And they're getting harder.
Yeah.
No matter how small.
No matter how small. What's that from?
I think that it's from Horton, Here's a Who.
Horton, Here's a Who, okay.
And finally, this is a nice one. I don't know if you're going to get this one. Today you are you. That is truer than true. There is no one alive.
Who is youer than you?
Yay!
All right, yeah. And, you know, I don't know if I know that one, but it seems like the Seuss logic flows so smoothly there. It almost had to be that.
Exactly.
It could be that. So Seuss, big part of your childhood? And
yeah,
parenthood?
Those books are kind of long, though, I got to say. They're
it
great,
It surprises
though.
Me. Yeah, yeah. But Go Dog Go, that one just dragged on. But otherwise, I loved reading Seuss to my kids.
Yeah, and we're going to go out with a little bit of Grinch.
You're a mean one, Mr. Grinch. You really